Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Mysterioso?
I'm just answering an email here from Rob Sterling's asking if he was on next week. Why, yes, he is on next week. Rob Sterling of the Conformist online magazine and Newswire and email list will be on with me next week. This week, I have no idea. Looks like there's some people on Facebook here, and they can message me if they want the... Studio number is 213-252-0998. I guess it's open lines. And I hope I can keep doing the show for a while. You know, I would like to hear... I was just thinking about it when I was in the car coming over here. The first show I did as a... I guess as a DJ that was broadcast was actually broadcast on the... old pirate radio station KBLT, which apparently Art Bell knew about when I was on that. I believe in October of 1997 or 8. So I've been on for nearly 15 years in some form or another doing some form or another of either pirate or internet radio and now podcasts. So that's a long time to be doing anything, I guess. The show's gone through different names. First, it was Hungry Ghost. Then it was Mind Control. And I think for a little while it was... might have been Synesthesia for a couple of shows, but then it settled into its final form of Radio Mysterio. So thanks in part, actually, in great part, to my friend Miles Lewis, who suggested it. He suggested it be Mr. Mysterio, so which is why that character is on the Facebook website, the Facebook site for Radio Mysterio. So there's a little figurine that looks like a man in black. It's glowing in the dark. That's the Mr. Mysterioso figure, which I don't even think you can buy anymore. I should have bought one. But that's the origin and the name of the show. If you want to call in, go ahead and do that. If not, I will. What did I just listen to that I thought was pretty amazing? I don't remember what it was. I can't think of two things at once. How about... I always like Margie's at the Linkin Park Inn, so let's listen to that while I figure out what we're going to do, if I'm going to read or tell you about something, or have people call in at 213-252-0998. Here's Bobby Bear, who is actually a favorite, I found out, of Travis Walton's. I played this Bobby Bear song with him in the car, and he said, hey, I like Bobby Bear. So let's listen to one of his big hits, Marge's at the Linkin Park Inn, here on Radio Mysterioso.
My name's in the paper where I took the Boy Scouts to hike. My hands are all dirty from working on my little boy's bike. The preacher came by and I talked for a minute with him. My wife's in the kitchen and Marge is at the Lincoln Park Inn. And I know why she's there. I've been there before. But I made a promise that I wouldn't cheat anymore. I try to ignore it, but I know she's in there, my friend. My mind's on a number, and Marge is at the Lincoln Park Inn. Next Sunday it's my turn to speak to the young people's class. They expect answers to all of the questions they ask. What would they say if I spoke on a modern day sin? And all of the margins at all of the Lincoln Park Inns. The bike is all fixed and my little boy is in bed asleep. His little old puppy is curled in a ball at my feet. My wife's baking cookies to feed to the bridge club again. I'm almost out of cigarettes, and Marge is at the Lincoln Park Inn. And I know why she's there.
Put the bone in, she asked him at the store. 'Cause my doggie's been hit by a car. And I do want to bring him home something. Put the bone in, she begged him once more.
The meat. I'm going to try it. I noticed Nick Redfern was online here, and I'm going to try and call him up here. Let's see if we can get him here on this number. He's at a friend's house. Well, it says connecting. See if he picks it up.
Hey, Greg.
Hey, Nick. I'm calling from my Skype from the show. How are you?
I'm doing good, thanks. How's it going?
Pretty good.
Good.
Are you going? You're going to be out here next week.
Yes, I am. Are we on the radio now?
Yes.
Okay. I wasn't sure if we were just mindlessly chatting or not.
Oh no, no. You have to be in.
Oh, okay.
You have to be in not radio mode, but Mysterioso mode, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm coming out Tuesday afternoon. It's actually kind of like a crazy whistle-stop visit where they got me flying into LAX about 5 o'clock Tuesday afternoon. Then I'm lecturing Tuesday night about 7 o'clock for, excuse me, LA MUFON on the Pyramids of the Pentagon book I did last year. And then crashing overnight in LA. Then someone's driving me down to Orange County Wednesday for a lecture there. For the MUFON Orange County Wednesday night on the same book. Then Thursday morning, it's like an early trip back up to LA and a flight out of LAX. So it's one of those blink and you'll miss me visits.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, I wanted to take you on the second half of the Weird LA tour to.
Yeah, no, that's a shame. I think, unfortunately, unless we can do some time bending things, I mean.
Yeah.
it might be difficult this time.
Yeah, Charles Bukowski's old apartment is still there, amongst other things. Part of the tour I didn't take you on last time.
Mm-hmm. Well, you never know. Who knows what'll happen? So.
Well, I know what'll happen. I'm going to try and get them to let me drive you from L.A. down to Orange County, but since I work at night, I can't really do it. I can't really stay and watch you speak. I can't watch you speak in either place. What are you going to talk about?
I'm talking about the
British Bigfoot?
Pyramids and the Pentagon.
Oh, okay.
Obviously they moved on. You know, they wanted it more UFO themed, and I thought rather than do a lecture that I'd done before, you know, at this conference or that one, why not do this one? Because I've actually only done, I think it's two lectures or maybe three altogether on the Pyramids book. That was for a group up here in the Dallas area called EPIC, and the other one for a move on San Antonio. And then the last one was when I spoke at the Paradigm Symposium in Minneapolis in October. So it hasn't really had that much exposure in terms of lectures. So I figured, you know, why not do that one? For both these places, and because again, a lot of people I think won't be exposed to that material, you know, rather than just sort of going over old ground or some boring old case that everybody's heard 45 times or whatever.
Yeah, but people like that. No, well, especially if it's a new twist on it.
If you're going to go along to a lecture, you know, it's all very well going to see a band that plays its old hits, but you want a bit of new stuff as well, you know what I
yeah,
mean?
Or a new way of, or covering yeah. somebody's tune that you haven't heard them do before or something, yes.
Exactly. So, but I mean, it'd be good if you can come down on the Wednesday of the day or something. I know the only hassle is that the guy who was originally going to take me, he's still taking me, I think, because he's got to then bring me back up Thursday, I think, so I'm not sure if he's staying over as well or what. I just don't really know what's going on, but I probably will closer to the time, hopefully. So.
Oh, okay. Well, if not, at least I'll come. Well, he'll probably come grab you in the morning on Wednesday, huh?
Okay, well, I mean, obviously I can keep in touch by the cell phone.
Well, we'll see.
You know, we'll figure it out. So, yeah.
We'll see what happens. You know, I was having this fantasy of just turning on the recorder while we were in the car and just using that as one of the shows. But maybe not.
Yeah, there you go.
and
a good way of doing it, actually.
Yeah, you're at your friend's house, so at any point you may feel free to say, I need to go. And I know you won't.
No, that's not a problem.
Okay, but if I'm keeping you on too long, just tell me.
No, I'm totally fine. I'm not doing anything right now.
I had a flyer in the car from the National UFO Conference, I think, or no, yeah. International UFO Conference, which is, you know, the Open Minds people are doing now, right?
Oh, the one in, used to be Nevada, now it's Arizona.
Phoenix, yeah.
Yeah.
I noticed they have, as one of their premier speakers, Micah Hanks on UFO Singularity, and then a panel on 21st century ufology with Stanton Friedman, Richard Dolan, and Micah Hanks.
That's kind of like a very diverse lineup.
Yeah, it is. I think it's a good lineup. It makes me uneasy because I wish I'd written something so I could be on that panel because I'd really like to talk to those people about it. But whatever, every time it comes up, I throw his name and say he's somebody that's saying something different now, in addition to, you know, oldsters like you and I.
Well, yeah, I mean, Micah's book, UFO Singularity, is a new one. I got sent a review copy of it just recently, and I haven't got that far into it yet, but I'm about 30 or 40 pages. And it is a good one, you know, it's sort of shaking things up, which is good. And I think, you know, if you got on the one hand on the panel Micah, and then at the other end of the spectrum, you've got Stan Friedman. You know, you're going to get hopefully a lively debate, which, you know, is far better than just, you know, just a lecture on, I don't know, the Betty and Barney Hill case or Pascagoula or something. You know, it's at least, you know, that's for me at least, that's kind of light at the end of the tunnel where a conference is doing really what all the other old-time conferences should do, and that's, you know, present new ideas and pit the old school up against the new school, you know.
Yeah.
It's a good thing. So.
Yeah, well, I hope so. I mean,
are you going along to it?
I am going to try. When is it? I didn't even look at the date.
Well, I know it's sometime. I think it's next month sometime. I'm not exactly sure when.
Okay, well, I'll try and make it for part of it. I don't know if I'll make it for anything but part of a weekend because I can't really I can't really take the time away from work.
Yeah.
I suppose I could rent a plane and fly there, which would, you know, as a student pilot, but I don't know if I really want to be taking such a long trip by myself when I don't even have my private pilot's license yet. But
you could always paraglide over the
Arizona,
or something.
Yeah, it would only take me about 3 days to get there. So, I'd like to show up
on top of the hotel, Mothman style.
Yeah, I'd like. You've never seen? Oh no, you did see me do that one time at Salvation Mountain.
Yeah, that's right. Was that the place that looked like the Planet of the Apes city? Is that?
No, that was what's it called? Mecca. This was Salvation Mountain was the place with all, where that guy has painted Bible verses all over that hill.
Oh yeah, well no, that's the one I meant. Where it looked like the Ape City at the first movie.
Oh, you mean you mean Slab City, probably.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah, maybe we should change the name to Ape City. I don't know.
That was the place, yeah, where you came over and in your device, whatever you call it.
Yes, the device.
And then I got that good picture of you when you were sat in it outside George Van Tassel's Integratron.
Yes, yes.
That was a good picture.
I was just thinking of, you know what? Today is Bob Emmenegger's birthday.
Oh, is it? He's not alive still, is he?
Yes, he's still alive. I just had him on the show like last month.
Oh, well, that's good.
Although I saw some on his timeline or whatever, somebody had said, "Sorry to hear that you had to go to the hospital. I hope you'll be well soon." I thought, "What? What? Really?" I didn't know that. I talked to him about once a month, and I wanted to have him on again. So, I think every time every time Bob Emmenegger is on, Grant Cameron listens to it and dissects everything he said and finds out new stuff that I'm not even aware of. Because Grant Cameron has a steel trap mind and is obsessed, and I have neither of those things. So he makes all these great connections. And Bill Moore emailed me recently.
Oh, cool.
So I don't know. I might go out to see him or... see him sometime during the year, but I don't think I'm going to bring up UFOs. Unless he does, I don't know. There's things that people want to ask him, and he just really doesn't care or want to talk about it anymore.
Yeah.
What are you working on, right?
Go ahead. Interesting private conversations.
Maybe. I mean, if there's something, perhaps I'll say, can we record something for like an hour, and maybe he'll say yes. Mm-hmm. And we won't talk about UFOs whatsoever and make everybody mad.
Yeah.
What are you working on right now? What's your next project, that if you can talk about it?
Yes, yeah, actually, just purely coincidentally, tomorrow or Tuesday, I'm sending the manuscript off to the publisher. It's called, it will be called Monster Files, and it's released in May. And it's all about allegations and files and testimony on government agencies and their interest in cryptozoology, you know, reports of things like, has the government autopsied a Bigfoot body, and there's official British Royal Navy files on sea serpent sightings and things like that. So.
And this is just these are things you've pulled out of the files where you just... How do you find these files on cryptozoology and if it's about ancient aliens, but you know what I mean. These off-kilter, off-color files that the governments have.
Well, I mean, certainly with the National Archives at London, where I got the Royal Navy files on sea serpents for the new book, I mean, it actually is as simple as typing into the search engine at the website, sea serpents or Loch Ness Monster. You know, you just run through a whole, you know, range of 14 things and see if anything pops up. And I mean, that is one of the good things about that, of many, at that National Archives in London, is that everything is extensively itemized, excuse me, on the website, not in the sense that, you know, there are massive PDFs where you can download the documents, but you can search on the document titles and then order them. Or, you know, if you're in London, obviously you can go and visit.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can type in sea serpents and find, as I did, reports from like the 1800s where ship's captains and crews have reported seeing these giant serpent-like creatures and filed reports. And what was interesting was that the Admiralty didn't just sort of randomly file them, you know, in the daily logbooks or whatever from the various ships. They actually had like a sea serpent file, you know, sort of like an early X-file type thing. So it's stuff like that. But I mean, also a lot of it is, you know, I've spent a lot of time going to archives, like the National Archives, you know, on the East Coast in Maryland. I've been there quite a few times, and every time I've been there, I've sort of just done searches on weird stuff. Other occasions, I mean, it's come from, I'll give you a, sort of a classic example.
Mm-hmm.
I got through the Freedom of Information Act, an old FBI file on ESP. And the that document itself, just there was a few internal references to a lot of early people who, you know, were sort of researching alternative issues and ancient mysteries, people like Puharich, Ruth Montgomery, and I was able to get their FBI files and other agency files, you know, which talked about how they were also researching pyramids and, you know, stuff like that. And I was able to use some of that material in the pyramids and the Pentagon book. But it was sort of a byproduct of actually just finding out that the FBI had an ESP file and thinking, well, that's interesting. But then it, because it internally referenced other people, you know, then it opened other doors to additional files. And that's often the way I find that you get an interesting file on a person or a case is because you actually didn't go looking for it, but it was happened, something was mentioned about it or the person, you know, in a file that was tangentially connected at least.
Yeah. It's weird. The way you find stuff a lot of the time, at least I used to find, is that you have to get the, well, maybe not the exact, but you get the most interesting stuff when you get the exact right query word or name or a group of words, especially on the internet. I mean, you if you put in Andrea Puharich and mushrooms, you'll probably get that video of him from the One Step Beyond show or something like that, or a reference to his book, The Sacred Mushroom.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'll give you another classic example. When I was doing research for the NASA conspiracies book, you know, one of the conspiracy theories around surrounding NASA is that, you know, were one or both of the space shuttle missions sabotaged? Well, the first space shuttle disaster, Challenger, which exploded in 86, the FBI declassified a couple of hundred pages of documents from that file. From the overall investigation, I should say, that talk about the different conspiracy theories where people had said they'd seen like laser beams fired at the fuel tank and all sorts of stuff. But what's interesting is that there's a 28-page, it's longer than that, but 28 pages are withheld from the file under national security regulations concerning a woman, a contactee who Jacques Vallée was in touch with, who said that higher forces or aliens had told that the shuttle was going to be sabotaged. And I had no idea that was in the file. You know, I was expecting to see stuff, as there is, you know, that people said it was terrorist groups or the Russians, you know. But to find that there was a contactee that Vallée had had contact with, and the FBI had interviewed her, and she, you know, there's a whole section in that file about how, you know, the Space Brothers or higher forces had supposedly said something's going to happen to the shuttle. And the FBI, you know, they went out of their way to interview her extensively, and a lot of those pages are still classified right now.
Ah, I want it under sources and methods, I'm sure.
Well, actually, it could be, but I mean, it's all under B1, which is national security.
Oh, okay,
you know,
okay.
It's different. So that in itself does kind of make it interesting.
Yeah, I can't. You've probably got those, withholding. What are the words? Designator things, memorize. I've got a little list that I had that I got when I got Bill Moore's FBI file that he gave to me.
Mm-hmm.
So it had a list of, you know, who had interviewed him and why they were redacted, and they were just codes, those, you know, B1 or whatever they are.
So it's often like that. It's often random ways, you know, you get something purely and simply because it pops up in somewhere you weren't really looking to find anything, you know.
Yeah, I've never been to the National Archives, and now I feel like I should go out there. But you have to go out there with a purpose, I think. That's how you start finding these other things.
Well, I mean, you do, but then again, you don't. I mean, if you're going there knowing what you're looking for, I mean, that does make your job easier because you're focused and you can just go straight in there and start. You know, they show you the process of searching for files and requesting them and all this business. So if you know what you're looking for, that's great, or who you're looking for. But, I mean, there is also a good argument to be made. You know, you could have a lot of fun and potentially uncover a lot of stuff if you just go in there thinking, you know, I'm just going to type various terms into the search engine, you know, and see what pops up. Certainly in the UFO field, a lot of people go there and they just access.
Yeah.
I know the Blue Book files or the OSI files associated with Blue Book. But, I mean, the one occasion when I went there, I started doing searches for people like Robert Sarbacker, who, as you know, he's one of these scientists back in the 80s who claimed knowledge of crashed UFOs. And I found some papers on him that linked with another guy, Eric Walker, who was also talking about crashed UFOs back in the 80s. I think actually with Grant Cameron, maybe. I'm not sure. But but anyway, you know, so you can do a lot of things like that and find threads and stories and all sorts of stuff. I mean, and when you get into the system, it becomes, you realize actually how easy it is to use, really. So it's worth a trip.
So what they have is they have a catalog there, computerized, that you can only access when you're there. Is that what you're saying?
Well, no. I mean, you can order files by mail, but it's no good sort of saying, send me the files on Robert Sarbacker. You know, it's like with the FBI.
You have to be specific.
You've got to provide something. You've got to be specific. I mean, if you've got the file numbers, that's even better. Or if you've got the case file, reference code, that kind of thing. Or you can provide specific biographical information, like, I don't know, if it's a military person, you know, if there's an obituary of them at the Air Force's website or something, you could send that along, you know, print it off and mail it. You can do that way. But in saying that, I mean, what I found typically every time I've been there is that you could say, if you're interested in hypothetically Roswell, and you wanted to know, maybe somebody gave you a tip-off that people at Oak Ridge in the summer of 47 had some involvement in autopsying a body. Well, you could ask for the files, the medical files from Oak Ridge in July 1947. Now, that might have a title of, I don't know, whatever, but if you dig into that file, you know, you'd be surprised how more often than not you find things in those files that aren't even referenced. You know, that the title of the file is so vague, it may just be something like medical records, July the 4th to the 30th, 1947.
Yeah.
But when you look into it, you know, there's all sorts of things there. I mean, I actually did this once where I was looking for files on Kirtland Air Force Base, see if they knew anything about Roswell in the summer of 47. One of the things I found was that there'd been an outbreak of a sort of quite virulent disease in and around Kirtland involving rats, you know, like a plague had broken out. Huh. And there was a lot of discussion about whether it had been spread deliberately by the Russians. And these files were going back and forth to, like, the head of the CIA, not the CIA, the head of the FBI and all sorts of people. You know, so a lot of weird stuff that isn't, you know, in any way mentioned in the headings when you go looking, but they're buried deep in the files.
Right. There's when I was researching Project Beta, I think you knew about this. I was looking at a list online of the files that Robert and Ryan Wood had gotten through the some of those Cantwell things. At least they were calling it MJ-12 type documents, and one of them was a listing of personnel and departments of the I believe it was the, it's not the NSA, well, it was one of the defense departments in 1981. And this is right in the middle of the period that I was looking at. And I thought, well, this might be interesting. And you know, sure enough, I can't think of names anymore, Nick. What is wrong with me? The scientist from the scientist from Kirtland that went to Paul Benowitz's house Jerry Miller.
Jerry Miller. Okay.
Yeah. Bill said, oh, well, he had all the tickets and he was high up. And then I realized he's head of space systems for, like, you know, one of these defense departments listed on there. And Jack Verona is listed on there. And, you know, a lot of people that pop up in the, you know, kind of the government paranormal thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just interesting to see these things and see who was in there. And I don't know why they had that personnel listing. No idea, but it had some confirming information in it, and then leads to other things. It had nothing. Mm-hmm. I just thought, well, it might be interesting to see who was there at the time. And Bob Wood sent me a page from it, and I said, "Can I borrow the whole thing?" And then he sent me the whole book through the mail, which was nice.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you know, it's one of the things I've found. A lot of people I've spoken to, they say, oh, well, there's just nothing to the FOIA material. It's just what they, quote, want you to know about. But the reality is you can learn a hell of a lot from FOIA material. You know, it's not fake material that the government's putting out to deceive us. You know, if they don't want you to see something, they just don't declassify it in the first place.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like this is fake material. And it does surprise a lot of people when the more you dig into it, FOIA actually is a very useful tool. I think it's becoming harder to use today, in today's world. But certainly, if you go after sort of obscure people in, you know, asking this agency or that one about, have you got files on this person or that person, invariably, you know, I've had a lot of good luck. I mean, to give you a classic example, when I was doing research years ago, this is actually back in England, back in the late 80s, into the Aztec story, and I filed with the FBI for their any documents on Leo Jabella, you know, one of the key players in the Aztec story.
Right.
Well, they sent me their files, which were about 400 pages or something like that, 300 pages. They had a bunch of other documents which originated with other agencies. Most of those were sent to me, and there were a hell of a lot of references to other people in those files that I was then able to get those people's files, because they had not only the people listed, but somebody had put in brackets the file number of that person as well. So I was even able to provide the FBI with the relevant file number.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not just saying it. I've actually found the FBI to be extremely helpful when it comes to FOIA material. You know, they're probably the one agency I've ever dealt with that really, you know, happy to send stuff. You know, they'd send hundreds of pages through the mail if they could release it, you know, so.
Yeah, it's
I'll be the first to admit that I'm pretty sure that the really good stuff, whatever that might mean or imply, just doesn't come up for FOIA, you know, it just doesn't.
Yeah, it comes down to, I think, as you say that, you know, there was a quote from some lawyer who began, I can't remember his name now, but he became interested in UFOs, Daniel Sheehan. And he said, he's been to a few UFO conferences, or he did for a while. He said the stuff that's available publicly is kind of frightening. And the thing, you know, the idea behind that, I think, is you have to know what to ask for. You have to know what you're looking for. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's a certain amount of respect for people that are looking for your stuff if you know what you're talking about. And you might find more way.
You're right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what I was going to say is, I mean, it's like Roswell. People say, I mean, I've seen people file requests, freedom of information requests for Roswell. Well, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard of, because if there's a file, it's not going to be titled Roswell.
No.
You know, you might have a file somewhere, hypothetically, titled something like Air Accident on the Foster Ranch, July 1947, you know. I mean, even that's too simplistic, probably, but it could be titled something like that, and there's no reason why it would even have Roswell in the title. You know, the only reason Roswell was linked was because the wreckage was taken to the base.
Yeah.
And even if it was something that happened on base, well, it may have a completely different name, you know. Just to file something generically like Roswell, just not going to cut it, you know. It's not going to happen. And I think that's one of the problems people don't realize, is that you do have to be very specific, not just in the subject matter, but how you request something and what the parameters are that you use as guidelines you know, being vague, just unless you're really lucky, it's just not going to get you anywhere.
Right. Well, being vague with anybody, but yeah, it's you find the specificity by doing what you said, which is looking through all these files with kind of a keen eye as to what's going on, who the players are, when things happened, agencies and time and personnel intersections, I guess you would call them.
Yeah, it's like using a jigsaw more than anything else. And if there are any names in there, you know, write those names down and try and find out who they are. Why were they mentioned in the file? Who are they linked with? And before you know it, you might have a hell of a confusing time going on, but you are beginning to put more and more people and scenarios together, which I think FOIA does help to do that quite a bit.
Yeah. I actually was able to see some of Charles Fort's notes one time.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't in an archive, it was in a library, but some of them were fascinating. He used them as a diary, sort of.
Mm.
Not just, you know, not to completely jump subjects, but just, you know, running through an archive and looking at things. They just brought out these shoe boxes and they had these little you always hear the story, they were written on little tiny pieces of paper. Yes, they were. They were written on little tiny pieces of onion skin paper and anything else that was around. And they were about the size of small Post-it notes, most of them. Thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of these things. And I don't know how he cataloged them or knew what was on them or what went where, but to save money, that's what he did. Write on these little pieces of paper, but there weren't just, you know, comments like, you know, frog fall in England in 1865. Mm-hmm. There are also things like, I don't know why I ever wrote that book, and I don't see why anybody would want to buy it, and I should probably just kill myself. Just stuff like that. No, really depressing stuff. Huh. You know, and the, you
actually,
know, it's interesting. Go ahead.
No, go on, finish up what you were saying.
No, it's interesting, as you could see, you know, it was important. Nobody really ever mentions this because anybody's ever bothered to look through all these things. And I want to go back there and look through those, and there might be more of a story there.
Might be put together like a collection of, you know, a book of his quotes and his thoughts and everything else.
Yeah, but most of it was, most of it was just, you know, people, most of it was his cataloging. But some of it was just every once in a while he'd think of something to say. And I just happened to run across a string of ones where he was really depressed. And he wrote them on these little pieces of paper.
Yeah, that does sound like some sort of weird depression.
Yeah, he's what did he say? He said, convinced that, what was one of his later books? Convinced Low is a flop.
Oh, yeah.
Should not have written it. You know, why didn't I just burn it? You know, stuff like that. I don't think he said he wanted to kill himself, but just really depressing things. So I don't know if this was pre-inheritance or post. But I guess he started most of his writing post-inheritance, right?
I think most of it was, because it sort of gave him the ability to do it, I guess.
Yeah. He didn't have to work a regular job or anything, luckily.
Yeah.
So that might be interesting. I mean, in past things, like I think Damon Knight, the science fiction writer, wrote a biography of Fort. I think there might be two of them right now, two biographies of Fort out. One was Knight, and one was, I think it was maybe written by, Andy Roberts or something. I think it was a British author did it. But, nobody really gets into the, you know, you hear about him and you hear about what he wrote, but nobody really gets into the personality of the man too much. There was an old Fortean Times article. Am I boring you, Nick? Uh-oh, I bored him. He went to sleep. Did Nick get cut off? Nick, can you hear me? I'll wait a little bit. Anyway, there was a article in Fortean Times about the diaries of... who was the head of the Fortean Society? Tiffany Thayer, I believe. And he had, there were just notes from his diary about him hanging out with Charles Fort and his wife and what they did. So that was a little fascinating piece of history, too. Nick, can you hear me? It says we're still connected, but I don't hear him. So I don't know if that's the Skype or what.
Hey, Greg.
No, I don't know what's going on. I'm talking, and then I said something like, right, huh? And I didn't hear you. Did you not hear me after a while?
No, it just cut off at this end, so I guess we just lost connection.
Oh, okay. What I was saying was I saw in the Fortean Times you don't hear about his personality, his personal life. There was an article in Fortean Times years ago, I think based on Tiffany Thayer, or who was the other Fortean, the writer. He wrote, it wasn't Tiffany Thayer, it was a writer. He wrote social novel, socialistic type novels. Anyway, he was one of the first presidents of the Fortean Society. Somebody's probably yelling it at home right now. Anyway, this is from his diary, and it was just them. It was just entries about him and his wife hanging out with Charles Fort and his wife, and playing chess, and drinking beers and stuff like that. So, just fascinating.
It's funny you should say that.
Go ahead.
Because one of the things I did want to mention is that Patrick Weege's Anomalous Books, they've just put out a new edition of John Keel's Jadu.
That's
and,
right.
Now, this book, obviously you can buy it anywhere on Amazon or any outlet, in a used format. But I would actually urge people to buy a new edition. Patrick sent me a review copy of it. One of the things you never really hear much about with Keel is his private life, his personal life.
Yeah.
Now, in the original edition, so I got the new book and read Patrick's introduction, but at the time when all this was going on, the book, he had a girlfriend, a German girlfriend, and she included significantly the sequel of the chapters. And can you still hear me?
Yeah, I can still hear you. You're cutting out here and there, though. We might have to cut it off here in a few minutes if it keeps doing this. Go ahead, though. He had a German girlfriend and what?
He had a German girlfriend, and she took an extensive role in the story. But by the time the book was finished, and the publisher couldn't get a release form from her to allow her part of the story to be included, so Keel was forced to write chapters and now included in the new edition. And on top of that, there's a section at the back of the book where they prepared a synopsis for the publisher for a follow-on book to Jadu. And I think probably the most amusing thing of all, there's actually a glowing review of the book included as well that was actually written by Keel himself under a pseudonym. So there's, if people want to read Keel's Jadu, yes, you can buy the original, in used format, but the new one is really good because he's got all this extra stuff by Keel and missing chapters and all sorts of things that if you buy the original, you'll never see it.
Right. Well, now I have to pick it up. That's one of two books I actually had signed by Keel. One of them was Jadu, and the other one was The Adventure, what was it called? The Fickle Finger of Fate, his softcore porno novel.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's sort of like racing cars around the desert. Is it that one or something? Like that?
No, I don't know what goes on in the book, but the cover has a guy on a scooter. Has a guy on a scooter and like on riding on the back of the scooter. It looks like a Marvel Comics picture. A guy on a scooter with a cape and a mask, and then a girl with big tits riding behind him.
Did he write it like about 65 or something?
It was in the mid-60s, 65, mid-60s. 67, something like that. Yeah. Anyway, and its real name's on there. It says John Keel, so. And when I showed it to him, he started laughing, and he said, I haven't seen one of these in a long time, probably for good reason.
I got his autograph on a couple of things. I never met him, but he signed a bunch of them. One was a paper he wrote all about, a very good sort of scathing look at the whole field of ufology. I think he wrote it years ago, and then he did like an updated edition back in the early 90s or something like that. It was like a paper, like a 10-page paper.
Oh, is it? Was it ever published?
Yeah, it's like a pamphlet. I'll dig a copy out next time I see you, and I'll copy it for you.
Oh, I'd love to see that one. I'd like to see what he had to say.
It talks a lot about paranoid, crazed lunatics in ufology and how it's like a small central unit of just crazy people. He just goes on off with this total rant about it all.
Well, he does in his books, funny, too, but I'd like to see something that's specifically dedicated when he was really pissed off one day and wrote that. I would love to see. I don't think I've ever seen that. It might pique my interest again. You know, more it's more interesting some of the history. I was on with Tim Binal a couple of weeks ago, and we just started complaining about ufology, and people on his list said, "Well, God, if they hate it so much, why do they even care anymore? Why do they even bother talking about it?" And it's it's like, no, we don't hate it. We just hate what it's become, and that nothing has changed, and would like to see it change.
I agree with you. I think ufology, it's like anything. If it becomes stagnant, it becomes pointless. And when it becomes pointless, it becomes tedious. And when something becomes tedious, you can begin to hate it. You know, and I don't think there's anything wrong with hating ufology if there's things wrong with it.
I think we hate the ufology. We don't mind the UFO part. The UFO part is still fascinating. It's just that the sledgehammer they've been trying to use to kill the fly has missed the fly completely for 50 years, or at least hit it glancing blows, and it's still flying around doing whatever it wants to do.
Well, at least there's some light at the end of the tunnel if Stan and Micah are going to be on a panel talking about the future of ufology.
Yeah, I might try to make it out for that, especially if it's on a day that I can get out of here. Or at least at that point, I might be on a day shift so I can go over there in enough time to see what's going on. Yeah, I would love to hear it and then stand up and say wrong or something, you know.
I mean, just the mere fact that they're willing to do that, you know, I mean, that's encouraging. I mean, that most conferences 10 years ago, you would never have even conceived of that. If you know, if the people weren't all in line with the ETH on a board, you know, sat on the stage all talking about when disclosure's coming or all that crap, you know.
Yeah.
If that would have been the approach, I mean, this is a step in the right direction. You know, next we want a big conference, you know, where you can have one of the main golden age era ufologists talking, you know, and then you come on next talking about, I don't know, Terence McKenna or whatever.
Yeah, it would be nice to have one of those conferences, and I'm beginning to think more that it would be I think that's sort of what was trying to be done with the Nick, I can't remember anything anymore. The online conferences I was doing with Walter and Kevin Smith. But that was the goal of that kind of a conference. But I didn't have real control about who was on. So, and I think Micah was on once, actually. It would be nice to see somebody kind of kicking ufology in the butt a little bit. To be fair, the one at the International UFO Conference is entitled Ufology in the 21st Century. I don't know if that means ufology sucks and needs to be changed in the 21st century. It's just called Ufology in the 21st Century. So... But like you say, just the mere fact of having somebody that's doing a little bit of different thinking and having them kind of with somebody that's dyed in the wool, old school, somebody that's maybe a bit more on the fence like Richard Dolan. I mean, I think he's still basically an ETH person, all that, very open-minded. For his part, actually, Stan Friedman is very open-minded. He doesn't, you know, reject things out of hand. He just has a very set way of looking at the phenomenon and... That's, you know, nobody's been able to change his mind about it. But the point is to get, and this is my favorite kind of debate, is to get the person that's the sharpest on either side of it and have them go at it.
Well, no, you're right. I mean, you know, sort of liven it up a bit, and there's nothing wrong, you know, with a good stand-up argument. I mean, why not? I mean, it's better than just giving a case history of this event or that event. I mean, that gets us nowhere.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it may help bring in new people, which is a good thing. But, I mean, it's like sometimes, you know, you can go to blogs and find that there's a post on Roswell about how, you know, were there four bodies or were there five? Or what does this word mean on the Ramey memo, you know?
Yeah.
It's like that is never going to get anybody anywhere. All this stuff about a mogul balloon coming down and whether or not the debris field, you know, matched the size of a mogul balloon. You can argue about this for the rest of our lives, and it won't make any scrap of difference to proving what happened.
Yeah.
And I think that's the problem with much of ufology. you know, I think because ufology, I don't mean this disrespectfully, I just mean it truthfully, that if ufologists think that by proving that a Mogul balloon didn't crash at Roswell, that that somehow proves aliens did, that's nonsense.
Yeah, all it proves is it wasn't a Mogul
balloon. We won the battle against the Air Force because we proved a Mogul balloon didn't go up that day. That's complete bullshit. That's bollocks.
Yeah.
You know, all it does is show that something probably was hidden, but we're not any clearer to understanding it. And that's I think, the same approach ufology has with the overall subject, that it's like, well, we know there's a phenomenon, and if it's something so strange and we've seen these strange beings, it has to be extraterrestrial, because what else could it be? You know, it's like this blinkered, black and white, sort of closed approach. If one thing is discounted, then it means it's got to be this or that.
Yeah. And there's thousands of other possibilities. Yeah. There's thousands of other possibilities if you don't have the comic book science fiction idea that it's aliens from another planet.
I don't discount it could be aliens from another planet, but if it is, they're acting so weird that it goes far beyond just, you know, alien scientists coming down in nuts and bolts craft. It goes way beyond that.
Yeah, I mean, it's to the point where it's something I've been pushing for a while, and I guess a few other people too, is that the interaction is what's important, not the fact that it might be aliens from other planets. What we're left with is our interaction with it and our reaction to it. That's what occurs, not some nuts and bolts craft and people coming to take samples of the soil and all that. That's not what's going on here. I think it's some sort of psychological, psychic, some level interaction, and that is the crux of it. Not seeing how fast the thing went, or you know how big was the ship, or what color was it, or anything like that.
Mm. No, you're right, and I think it comes where 50% of the lectures at a mainstream conference ask those sort of questions, then ufology will have a future.
Yeah,
and if it doesn't. If that doesn't happen, I think ufology will still have a future, but it'll be just one sort of mired in history. You know, it'll be sort of relegated to the sidelines, and it'll be kind of along the lines of something where people used to investigate, I don't know, Victorian seances, you know, where there's still an interest in it, but it becomes a historical interest.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like Jack the Ripper. I mean, it's like you can't say anything else about it really today. So you have a bunch of people who still sit around talking about what they know and how far they've been able to take it, and that's it. And ufology could go down that path, or it could go another direction if people are open to, you know, not branding it just with the ETH. But I mean, the reason why that's been done is the commercialization of the subject.
Yeah.
You know, and people say, oh, well, Nick's one to talk because he writes books, you know, about the subject, which is true. But even though I'm saying it myself, you know, I don't stick to existing paradigms and say what people want to hear. You know, I wrote a book on Roswell saying aliens didn't crash. I wrote a book about aliens and the demonic angle, you know. So I always try and think outside the box, but the problem is, it's the ETH angle that brings people in at the conferences and sells the books in large quantities, you know.
Which that's is why they should be online for
that's
a while.
That's why, you know, that's why those of us who write books, despite how many we write, you know, you're not sort of rolling in millions of dollars, because I don't say what people want to hear. But I'm not going to take the cynical approach and write books saying what people do want to hear just for the sake of it. But I think, unfortunately, people know the ETH sells, and conference organizers get more people in by promoting that angle. And that's, for me, that's wrong. You know, that's like,
you know what? I think it'll be that way we've talked about this, until one, the phenomenon decides to change itself or do something different. Or two, somebody can present different ideas about the subject in a way that's easily understandable to most people.
No, that's actually a very good point. I think, you know, some of the alternative scenarios, you know, you can get really caught up in, particularly if you need to sort of really give an audience in 45 minutes or an hour an overview of a really sort of paradigm shifting scenario.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to be good at doing that. It's no good having sort of 3 hours to bullshit over a few pints. You know, you've got to get your message across.
Yeah.
And hammer it home. And so, yeah, I think that's actually a very good point, is that a lot of people have heard, you know, about things like tulpas and DMT, but they may not fully understand the scenarios. And we've got to get that across to the more mainstream aspect, I think.
Oh, I'm sorry, Nick. I've got a call. Hey, Kurt, do you want to be on here with Nick and ask him something? Yeah, hey, Nick, is it okay to have a caller with a question?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, just a second. Let me turn this up. There. Can you hear us, Kurt? Are you there?
Yeah, if you'd rather do it on Skype, I'm set up. I have a request sent into you.
Okay, well, unless this is a problem on the phone right now, we'll just do it on the phone because the Skype here is totally unreliable, and if I got two people coming in, it might freak out.
Hey, Nick, Happy New Year, man.
Hey, Nick, can you hear him there?
I'm sorry, sir, you broke up a bit then. Say that again.
Kurt, it's Kurt, right? Hello?
No, Chris O'Brien.
Oh, Chris. Oh, hey, Chris! Jeez, hey, Chris, how's it going?
Happy New Year, guys.
Happy New Year, Chris. Can you hear him, Nick?
Who is it, Chris? Who?
Chris O'Brien.
Oh, I didn't realize it was you. Okay.
I didn't either because I was concentrating on you and then the phone, and now I've got it turned up so I can hear both of you.
Yeah, well, I saw your notice on Facebook, and I thought, you know, I got to give Greg a Happy New Year, and then I tune in to Kill Radio, and there's Nick. How fortuitous. Two birds and one stone. Hey, you guys, I'm really enjoying the show, and especially where the conversation was when I just couldn't resist and called in.
Well, I'm glad you did. What do you think of what we were saying? I mean, basically, you know, one, it's boring.
Absolutely.
Two,
I mean, you know,
it's got to come from...
like three peas in a pod with some other peas, too. You know, this whole thing has to change. It has to move forward. You know, Nick, you know, brought up the very, I think, well-worn term, out of the box. So, you know, this whole field is in real need of some creative, out-of-the-box thinking, analysis, hypotheses, you know, and some field research, if possible, real-time stuff, you know?
Yeah. If you know, if people can, they kind of have to be. How is your San Luis Valley camera thing going?
Fits and starts. You know, it's kind of a catch-22. You know, you need to produce results before you can get the interest, but you need to have the interest before you can produce results. It's, you know, it's like everything else when it comes to you know, doing actual, you know, real-time research and stuff. You need the gear, you need the technology. You know, we're dialing it all in, but, you know, it's like fits and starts. It's like everything else, you know?
Yeah. I know what I wanted to ask you. You heard what we were saying and what, you know, Nick and I were saying. We think things should change and maybe in this way. What do you think about that issue, about the changing ufology? What might change it either from inside or from the phenomenon itself?
Well, I don't know. There's really no one size fits all answer to that, Greg. As I'm sure you and Nick both would agree.
Yeah.
I think it takes a concerted effort to educate people, or actually uneducate them. You know, deprogram them from the pop culture, you know, programming that you guys have been talking about, and somehow come up with a way to reprogram them with the whole idea of approaching the subject from completely new and different oblique even angles, you know. We've talked about this, Greg, many times. Nick, you know, obviously on the Paracast, we've discussed aspects of this. So I love body snatchers because that, to me, really, you know, the amount of furor and you know, people scratching their heads going, what is this? I mean, that to me was like really a slam dunk for Nick. You know, we need to take subjects like Roswell or the whole abduction phenomenon. And I mean, you come up with a whole list of kind of subject areas and just, you know, trash what we think we know and start from scratch. You know, I think that's the way to do it. And the only way to do that is to deprogram everybody from their preconceived, front-loaded, you know, projections that have been sort of formulating their reality view. And then take that blank slate and move it forward.
Hey, Nick, do you think that people can be re-educated like that, or is it kind of too late?
Well, actually, that's a very good point, because we could, you know, simplistically, we can sort of take the view, well, we just need to get the other ideas and theories across to people. But Chris is quite right. With 50 or 60 years of being kind of saturated with the whole ETH angle, there really is this need for people not just to be told of the other theories, but to really, almost quite literally, be deprogrammed from just being saturated by the other stuff. And I'm absolutely certain you won't change the minds of people who've been into the subject for 50 years, 40 years. You know, it's kind of like how some old people are frightened of the internet or technology. You know, you'll just never get them involved in it because they're just too, you know, it's so overwhelming for them. But other people do embrace it.
Well, I'm talking about the kids. I mean, we really need, I hate the word need, wish, want, hope. Yeah, I think it's imperative for us to come up with a way to expose new thinking to young people who haven't been front-loaded by 50 years of book reading and going to conferences and, you know, warm butts in the chair in the conference hall. I think it's too late for them, to be honest with you. And I do agree with you there, Nick. It would be very difficult. But you know, I think it's a concerted grassroots effort, you know, with the younger, the under 35 generation, basically.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that somebody in that generation, younger, are going to be open to that because they're going to be, you know, if they have half a brain about them, are going to be notoriously, regularly untrusting and rejecting of what's come before, and hopefully in a good and constructive way. Like, you know, having UFO punks on the scene might be nice. I don't know if any going around right now, really.
I really like the whole online conference model that you and Walter came up with. I think that's a real good start. You know, I was very proud to be part of that inaugural broadcast or webcast. And, you know, I think that's a really potential avenue, I think, and it could be a very fruitful one, you know, to jazz it up somewhat. I think it needs to be taken out of the realm of pure academia and pure research and FOIA requests and that, you know, that whole nuts and bolts approach that's really important, obviously. But to attract people and to really hook them, I think you need to come up with a really well-thought-out, you know, shtick, just some sort of declaration, you know, like Occupy Ufology or something, you know.
Yeah. Did you hear me a little while ago?
I was really going to take that.
Yeah. Did you hear me a little while ago? I said, how about, you know, it'd be something that that would, I don't know about shock people, but, I know what it was. It was, somebody needs to be able to explain different concepts in a way that's readily accessible to most people.
Well, not acceptable, understandable. We're dealing with very complex,
accessible. I said accessible.
And just, you know, basic fundamental, you know, agreements. And, you know, the languaging, obviously, is a crucial issue. But once you get past or get through the languaging, you have to come up with, you know, a redefinition that's subdivided. I mean, it's really going to take something that creative and that just out of the box.
You know,
you say the word UFO, you say the word alien, you say, you know, spaceship, you say abduction. These are very deeply rooted archetypal terms in the collective. And so what you have to do is come up with new ones that hint at those, but kind of steal their thunder.
Yeah. What I did say was accessible, not acceptable. I don't care whether it's acceptable or not. Accessible
right. Okay.
Terms.
Yeah, I've got a garbled connection here a little bit. I'm on a cell phone, so.
Yeah. Nick, you still there?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's also one other angle to look at, and that's when you talk about sort of next generations and the one after that and the one after that. I think the main thing, you know, it's not just a case of getting ideas across and sort of deprogramming, but one area we need to think about is if the next generation, the one after that, are actually going to give a shit about ufology. You know, it's kind of, I mean, joking aside, I mean, it's a valid point. I mean, you look at how society has been dumbed down so much in the last few years and educational levels are dropping. It may not be that we haven't got a message to say in 20 or 30 years. It isn't profoundly important, but it's whether or not anybody's going to care to listen.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like...
Well, so are we talking about this, elitist thing? Are we talking about a grassroots thing? I mean, to me, it's important to educate people, especially in areas where this stuff tends to happen, you know, I guess more frequently, for lack of a better... You know, there's a statistical probability in some areas that you can have, you know, more of a potential events occur. And so maybe target your influence and your out-of-the-box thinking in these areas. That's what I've always championed. It's got to really start, I think, at a grassroots level now. You really have to almost throw the baby and the bathwater out, you know. I don't know how else to say it.
You know, Chris, in about 2 years ago, I think the last public talk I gave was at the Wake Up Now conference, and I basically said throw all of ufology out, and I had people walking out. And I didn't say throw it out. I said get rid of the big organizations. Concentrate on small organizations who communicate through the internet and through online conferences. Stop abduction research, at least in the big abduction research, capital A, capital R. And, you know, people need support and things like that. That's fine. And they need to be able to tell their stories and need to be able to share these things with other people to kind of work through it. But to have that, you know, turn into an industry where people, you know, go to conferences and write big books and all that, I think that kind of it's hurting it now. And just throw all the old, you know, throw these ideas out or put them on the back burner and see what happens. Or do something really radical and force an idea upon it and see how long
that goes. That's what I'm saying. A complete redefinition, just a whole new languaging.
Yeah, and see what happens.
Obviously, it's going to have to come from there.
Yeah, and don't be stuck. And this is the hard part. Don't be stuck to what you find.
Yeah, well, we know everything is malleable and fluid in this whole realm of you know, research. So, I mean, that kind of goes with the territory. I think it's been too rigid, too calcified, too kind of ivory-towered almost in a weird, you know, how would I put it? I mean, ufology is, you know, it's a circus. It's free-form, unregulated... you know, show, and certain people try to carve out careers and, you know, based on theories and viewpoints and foregone conclusions and assumptions. You know, that's why I love you guys and your work. Nick, you know, you cannot pin Nick down except to pin him down that you can't pin him down, you know? And I love that approach. It's open-ended. It's making people think. Obviously, this is not something that you're going to be able to get across to, I think, the average person. I think you need to have that kind of seeker energy, I think, that we three share. And that thinking aspect is, you know, that strata of our culture, unfortunately, is shrinking. And I think we need to target our efforts to you know, towards the people out there who are younger than us, that are seekers. I mean, so many people are just bewildered by the kaleidoscope of the media and their lives, and, you know, everybody has their head down texting. They're not looking up when things are flying around, you know? We need to change that mindset somehow.
I don't know if that can be changed, except in the fact that, I got this from, of all people, Mario Pozzaglini, the alien writing guy that died in, like, 97, 98. He said that he was dealing, what his specialty was kids that were you know, teenagers and maybe up into college age that were kind of that were severely either drug addicted or disturbed or something like that. And he said in a lot of cases, a lot of the cases that he worked with, if he showed them something that they did not know before, that made sense and subverted what they thought they knew and that had been shoved down their throats, there was this, he said there was this transformation. Because in a lot of cases, they were just very different and they wanted to know that there was somebody else that was looking at something in a different way that was older than them and said, yes, I know that, you know, everything isn't what everybody thinks it is. But he would show them this different way just by saying, look at the weird stuff that's been going on in history that they don't teach you in class. And they would all light up.
How do you apply that, you know, systematically to a potential subculture or an emerging subculture? How do you apply that?
I think by being a cheerleader, you know, maybe with something, eloquent cheerleader, you know?
Yeah. Greg, I don't know, pom-poms and a little short skirt. maybe if you're, you know, one of the 49er cheerleaders, congratulations out there on the Niners. I think they're the team to beat, actually, this year. Really exciting game yesterday. I don't know if you're a football fan. I know you're a baseball fan.
Yeah, I don't even know how football is played. That's how little I know football.
Well, the Niners are the team to beat. They're going to the NFC Championship game next week, and then probably the Super Bowl, I think.
Oh, maybe so.
Don't quote me.
Nick, are you still there? Uh-oh, we bored Nick to death. Nick, are you there? Oh, well, he got cut off. We didn't let him talk, and he got cut off.
Uh-oh.
Oh, no, I'm fine, thanks.
I hope I didn't monopolize it.
Well,
Nick, if you're listening, you guys got me going. I couldn't resist. I had to call in.
Well,
rah, rah, rah.
Well, let me try calling Nick again and see if I'm going to, and just tell him, look, if we keep getting cut off.
Well, Happy New Year, Greg, and to Greg's dedicated listeners out there. Good stuff, as always.
Okay, let me see if Nick wants to stay on or not, or if he's just not.
Greg.
Sorry, Chris said, I must have monopolized, and Nick went to sleep, and then the phone cut off.
No, it's just, I'm sure, just a signal going down.
Well, do you have something to add to what, you know, Chris and I were not complaining, but just the idea of getting younger people interested and getting them excited. I said, you know, Chris says, what's needed? And I said, an eloquent cheerleader, probably.
That's a good one, actually. That would work. Yeah, I think the main thing, you know, is getting new ideas across, because I think that will bring it to a new audience. But I think we always, like I said earlier, one thing we've got to remember or look at is whether or not the subject is going to have a viable audience in the future. I mean, you can go back to, say, the early 70s and find how things like the Bermuda Triangle and astrology were huge, you know, and then they just died away. Crop circles, that's not the following that it did have.
Yeah.
I mentioned earlier, Michelle, like Victorian seances. All these subjects have their own followings, but in many respects, they're far smaller than they were when they were at their peak. Now, that could happen to ufology. You know, we assume that people are going to keep running to the subject in droves like they have done since the late 40s, but maybe the subject has peaked, and getting across the ideas and the themes and paradigms and new thoughts is great if people actually want to listen. If all they want to do is sit in the bedroom and text their friends and watch dumbed down reality, then that's not going to happen, you know. So I think there's the angle of not just getting the message across, but looking at how the changes in society impact the subject, possibly quite adversely in the future, I think.
I think if people are interested in something, they're going to seek it out and find it. I don't think you're going to go get people who are so disinterested or stupid or whatever that they don't care. I mean, those people are lost anyway. It's not going to happen. But the people who do care and do want to do something about it, they will make a difference, because they just can't help it, because they'd be filled with the fervor or whatever. But I don't think it
boils down to the media. You know, Nick is pointing out something very important, and that is what's in vogue and what's fashionable and what is viable. in terms of creating some sort of super meme as opposed to just a collection of memes, you know? And that's I think that's where obviously the internet and the media, the new media, the whole new approach, I think it's emerging in culture to subject matter. I think that can be used as a tool to circumvent some of the, you know, the pitfalls of the old sort of paradigm that ufology and the paranormal have evolved through. It's a brave new world, I think, and it can be. I think that these subject matters can be posed in such a way to really capture the imaginations of the people that need to keep asking questions and be, you know, seeking.
Yeah.
And what do you think, Nick?
Well, yeah, I mean, I do agree in the sense that I think if there are people out there, if they're interested, they're going to end up looking for it. But equally, I think, you know, it's kind of like there are less magazines on the newsstands, the subject is more sort of internet-based, and it's not as visual, I think. Although it's very visual in terms of what's available, I don't think it's as visual in terms of where people just might walk past a newsstand and see a magazine, and that really gets them into it. You know, they go to the bookshop and they happen to see the picture of communion staring at them, like when that came out back in the 80s.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, does that happen today with book covers? You know, for somebody that a whole audience is enraptured by this cover that they see and they walk in a bookshop. That's because people don't walk in bookshops as much. So I do think, although, you know, there is a good article says that people are going to gravitate to the subject if they're interested. I think there have been certain subtle changes where there isn't that ongoing interest as much, I think, as in every next generation there was in the past. But I mean, it could completely change. There could be something where something creates a huge subject. That's a far bigger following and exists even today, you know. I mean, it could be just so alternative that you just haven't thought about it.
Yeah, well, that was my suggestion about forcing it into some kind of paradigm just to see what happens. Because I bet you, if you force something into the paradigm, it will fit that one, at least for a while. The funny thing is that, you know, to try and get some sort of a signal from the phenomenon itself, I think might be impossible, because it's so tied up in what we think and what we expect and the ways we go about looking at things and getting proof for things, quote unquote. And that's the difficult part of it. Probably the easiest part of it would be just to sell the excitement of a new idea that can be encapsulated in a few sentences or one sentence or, you know, an image in a few sentences. That I think that's the trick. And then if you get, you know, some sort of group or concatenation or what's the word, enough people thinking about it at the same time, you can change the way the phenomenon interacts with us. And at that point, I think there will be a change. I don't know if it'll be the right change, but at least it'll be different, and maybe it'll give a different point of view, us all a different point of view of what we're dealing with.
Yeah, I agree. I think being proactive is really important. And that's, you know, coincidentally and kind of ironically, that's the thing that really kind of excited me about Stephen Greer about 20 years ago when he first came out and the whole C-SETI thing first started. I think back then that kind of wide-eyed innocence with lack of ego attachment, it was very compelling. And the whole idea, I think, Nick, wasn't there a valet that said it appears like we're dealing with some sort of program, and if that's the case, why can't we interject some sequence into the code? And get proactive and, you know, attempt to, you know, kind of similar to Close Encounters when they play the, you know, the synthesizer and try to establish a language. That whole idea, I think, is a good one. And, you know, with the internet and some creative thinking, you know, you could come up with a pretty cool, I don't know, experiment. You know,
I think we all need to talk extensively about this off air, because now you've both got me all excited about it.
well, I don't, you know, I'll send you some cool towels. you know, I think the whole idea of being proactive is a good one. Ray Stanford, I mean, one of the first things he did as a kid, I mean, how old was he? 16, I think, 17?
Yeah.
Not even. He was taking Keogh's idea, what was it, Project something or other, Sunbirds, Skybirds, something like that.
Starlight?
Where they were, they would create these sigils with lit candles on the ground to attract the UFOs.
I mean,
that was very inspirational to Ray and Rex. And I think the whole idea of communication, a proactive thing, interjecting some line of code into the program on some level, I think electronically, you know, through the internet. I mean, some creative ritual almost thinking could be applied to it and stir it up. You know, everybody's been so reactive. We're logging the data and we're like, wow, wasn't that cool, you know, 30 years ago. I mean, let's get proactive on their ass, you know?
The other thing that I think I've talked about both of you is I stopped putting down the collection of data and the old collection of data because there are patterns. I'm almost certain there are undiscovered patterns in those reams of data.
Oh, absolutely. My database is filled with them. I've identified some already. I haven't published, you know, that information. But absolutely, you know, and that's why Jacques Vallée needs to be brought into this equation on some level. The guy is, you know, he's a computer scientist. He looks for patterns. That's his passion. And, you know, he's professionally been doing that for 40 years, longer. You know, someone like Vallée, I'm sure he's come up with some incredible patterns. We need to bring, you know, that computational warmth to bear on this because, you know, these databases are important, but, you know, I think we need to get proactive.
Either that or what Nick said about using the right search and query terms. Are you still there, Nick?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I mean, this whole issue of hidden patterns is an interesting one. I mean, one of the main reasons being, because, I mean, my other big interest apart from UFOs is cryptozoology. Now, you know, it's sort of no secret thing, a lot of these crypto creatures, they're something sort of far less or more, however you want to term it, than just flesh and blood animals, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think that one of the, well, and I don't think, I mean, one of the parallels I found is that in regions and locations where you have UFO activity, very often you have Bigfoot type activity in the exact same place. Now, the problem is the mainstream ufologists don't want to touch cryptozoology because they think it's going to impact adversely on their subject. And the cryptozoologists do exactly the same. They don't want UFOs brought into the Bigfoot mix. And so nobody wants to deal with that data. So it kind of languishes in this sort of twilight zone area, if you like. But you can find clear analogies, geographical, time-wise, etc., you know, where you've had reports of strange creatures and strange lights in the sky at the same place. And also, you know, somebody has a UFO experience and they have synchronicities afterwards. You know, you can find that kind of crossover data. The Men in Black stuff, you know, the number of people who have been involved in the Men in Black mystery who weren't just involved in UFOs but dabbled in the occult as well. How many of those had MIB experiences or things happened to them of an MIB nature? You know, all these little things that often get overlooked because each side feels it's too awkward for their group to touch gets missed. And I think there's a lot of data like that that if we really sat down, we could probably, I won't say pinpoint anything definitive, but we'd actually see patterns that we just, right now, just a scramble of data because no one wants to deal with it.
Yeah, or something that I'd thought of a while back, well, maybe it wasn't me, I don't know who it was, but change the questions you give to people and follow up with them. Don't just ask them what happened and what came up over the horizon, what color was it. Ask them, how did it make you feel? What happened 3 weeks later? Did you get phone calls? Was somebody hanging around your house? Did you act differently around people? Did people act differently around you? Things like that.
Mm-hmm. No, I totally agree. Yeah. I've been doing that for years. And touching bases with people, you know, down further down the line, calling them up, finding out how they're doing, just, you know, keeping tabs on people. There's been a few important cases I've had where, you know, I've been doing that.
And what's what what have you found by doing that, like something that really sticks out to you?
That people's reality views were changed.
Right.
That I get a sense that they feel that there's a lot more going on in their reality than they would, if those events or event hadn't happened, that they would think, you know, in other words, the person now has a changed reality view. And I think most of the time it hasn't been a drastic thing where it's like threw them into some true believer direction or put them into religion. That has happened, but I think the average person, you know, it's just kind of opened them up, basically, their reality view.
Yeah, it's that's funny, because didn't Valet suggest that with his matrix of UFO, what was it called? He created this chart showing what happened during a UFO event, what happened to the local environment, what happens to the physical environment, what happened to the person.
Well, right.
Physically,
societal, weather, unusual government military activity. I've been monitoring all that stuff in the San Luis Valley for many years. I mean, obviously, not being there, it's not as easy for me to keep a really super accurate log of what's going on. I'm missing all sorts of stuff. But for 10 solid years, I was on the ground monitoring everything.
Yeah. And I have another question for you. Did the way you and other people thought about it change over the time that you were there and make the phenomenon change as a result of it? In any way?
You know, I can only speak for myself. If anything, it's made me more skeptical, more objective, more critical, looking to, really come up with a prosaic answer that'll explain some particular event. It's the series of events that occur in little waves or packets that are harder to explain away. You know, isolated events, obviously, a vast majority of lights seen in the sky are going to have some prosaic or mundane explanation. I think Nick would agree with that. But I think people have become more discerning and less likely to report unusual activity. Generally, it's visitors who are impressed with something now. I think the locals are more circumspect and I think more discerning.
Yeah, well, they'd have to be if they've got, if they've got an overload of information there, they have to figure out what is the signal and what is the noise and what might be something different or what might be something they have to pay attention to.
Right, well, you're talking about just an average everyday reality. It's not like these things are flying around every night.
Right,
right. They have to, pick and choose what are real and what are not. I mean, these are like events that maybe the average person there would experience 10, 20 times in their life. So it's a whole network. It's like monitoring the pulse of activity. You know, most people now, the kids, man, they're looking down at their cell phones texting. They're not even bothering to look around in their, near or distant environment. We're seeing a real, I don't know, forget eyes to the sky. It's just not happening anymore.
Hey, Nick,
are you... people get heads-up displays on their retinas or something.
Nick, are you still there?
Yes.
Yeah. I would actually ask you that question amongst the people you've contacted, specifically maybe for the I can't remember the name of the book. The Collins Group type people and other people you've contacted in the government, do they have a kind of a classical view of what the UFO subject is, or is there sort of a dichotomy or camps of people with different ideas?
I think, that there's this tendency to assume that the government is like one unified entity and that they have this unified belief, or conclusion. Now, if there is, whatever the deep secret is about the UFO field, or the phenomenon, I should say, maybe there is some group in government that knows what that is. But, I mean, we can look back throughout history, the last 60 years, and see how various government agencies have looked at the subject and come to different conclusions. I mean, you had things like Sign, Grudge and Blue Book, which granted a fairly low level, but there were people in those groups who thought it was extraterrestrial or could be, like Rupert. Others thought, you know, it was weather balloons or whatever phenomena. There's, for example, a U.S. Weather Bureau report from 1947 that delved heavily into ball lightning. Then in the 1950s, you had the Robertson panel, which was less interested in what UFOs were, but more interesting how, from a psychological perspective, the phenomenon could be manipulated by the Russians. Then just a few years ago, back in England, the British Ministry of Defence declassified the report called the Condine Report that suggested UFOs were plasmas, plasmas that could actually have an effect on the human mind. So, in other words, you know, I don't believe these are cover stories. I think they are legitimate attempts by individual agencies or departments to try and get to the bottom of the mystery and coming up with a conclusion. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a far more secretive, you know, MJ-12 type group, if you like, that has the answer. Maybe they do. Or maybe it's just like us. You know, maybe right now there's a conversation going on between a bunch of guys in the Pentagon who are on duty, you know, through the night, sitting around saying, I wonder what really happened at Roswell, you know. That could well be going on, because we have a tendency to think if the government's investigating something, it's doing it because it's got all the answers. You know, we assume, I've got a good old government, they're looking after us. They might be hiding the fact that they're not really sure what is going on, rather than having all the answers.
Right.
Yeah, I'm sure they are, actually. That makes total sense to me.
Yeah, well, this is something we've talked about on the show and over the years, that the, you know, the disclosure thing, is the lack of disclosure is not because there's something being held back so much as a wealth of knowledge, so much as a lack of one, and a lack of knowing what is being dealt with, and the fact that it can't be controlled. And if you,
yeah, I think one of the important things is that, you know, with disclosure, it's kind of like this situation where even if disclosure occurs, well, if it doesn't meet what the disclosure people are expecting to hear, they're just going to say, well, it's not real disclosure anyway.
Right.
You know, imagine if the government said, we are going to come clean, and we've got a lot of reports, we've got a lot of radar reports, pilots encounters, abductions, we know something's going on, and we suspect a lot of other stuff, but Roswell really was a balloon. We have never actually got physical hard evidence. Well, it doesn't matter how much good stuff the government's admitted to and said this is disclosure. A fair percentage would still say, well, it isn't disclosure because you said Roswell didn't happen. You know, it's like, so unless it meets the merits of what people are expecting, it'll never be viewed
accepted,
as disclosure anyway.
Yeah, if they don't hear what they want to hear, then it's not disclosure, which is, it's a vicious circle. And it's, I think a lot of those people aren't aware of that. Chris, is that you with the radio up? The Skype here is screwed up, and it's one of the reasons why I'm kind of teetering on, I think I'd rather do the show where there's some place where I can get a decent Skype connection when there aren't other people using the, because I think it's partially something that's going on in the server, and also because there's usually two or three other people trying to use the same Wi-Fi, and it just breaks down the Skype.
It could also, Greg.
Yeah?
It could also be due to the secret agenda of the evil government.
Yes, it is. I'm sure that's what it is. Was it you or somebody that said? Oh no, it was. I had a write up for when I had Tim Beckley on, and I said he'd publish such books as, you know, the Commander X books, and of course the famous secret plan of the shadow, the evil secret plan of the shadow government, which was a totally made up title, but it sounded like something that would have been published.
Yeah, it does, actually. That would be a good one. There actually is a book called Evil Agenda of the Secret Government. It really is. You look it up, it's on Amazon. I forget who it's by now, but it was published by, I think, I think it's Global Communications or not, but if you look it up, you'll find it, Evil Agenda of the Secret Government. Which is an excellent title, by the way.
I want to have that just to have it on my shelf, just like I have one called Life's Riddle Solved. I just have it on the shelf just because people come over and say, well, why do you need any other book? You've got this book here.
Oh, good. Well, you didn't point that one out to me last time I was there.
Oh, okay. Well, next time you come out, I'll put it up on Facebook. Everybody can see it. And
just put the cover on. I don't need to read it, believe me.
No, you don't need to read it. No, we don't need to read that one. We've all solved life's riddle, right? We've got five. Yeah. We've got 4 minutes left
the
here.
The spine must be very attractive.
Oh yes, it is. It's got some kind of new agey looking drawing on it, and it's printed only in two colors: blue and black and blue, which I somehow is appropriate. But we've got like 4 minutes. Is there anything you two want to hash out
I just want to say, hey, happy New Year, Nick and Greg, man. Sorry, I crashed the party, but I just couldn't resist, man.
I'm glad you couldn't resist.
So, yeah, that's good.
I'm your biggest
that's
fans,
good.
And onwards and upwards for 2013. And I'm not going to predict or prophesize, but I have a feeling that we're going to have a very interesting summer around the end of July, beginning of August, just for whatever.
I'm not even going to ask you why.
I don't know. It's halfway between two comets.
Right. Yeah, there's the June or April comet, and then there's the supposedly big one in the winter.
Well, it's March. There's a March comet.
March,
and, okay. Yeah, the new one, the big one in November, yeah.
Ions, I think it's called.
Yeah, two Russian guys, I think, found it.
Yeah, it's named after their system.
For some reason, I just get a hit about halfway in between those two cometary visitations to the solar system. We're going to have some interesting stuff going on. Don't ask me, you know, why I think that. I'm just putting it out there.
Excellent. Okay, Chris, thanks. And we have to have you on again soon, both of you, Nick, and then maybe both on again, because this was a fun conversation. I don't think we're at the end of it here, so we'll get the Skype working.
All right, cool.
All right. Well, I'll talk to you both soon, and I'll see Nick next week here.
All right, cool. See you later, Chris. And I'll see you on the Tuesday.
Good talking to you, Nick. Happy New Year, and onwards and upwards, man. Both of you guys.
All right. Bye-bye. Thanks so much.
See you later.
All right, see ya.
Good night.
Bye. I think it was Nick. Chris hung up too, I think. Yeah, okay, they both hung up. It's been Radio Mysterioso. Thanks so much for listening. This is one of those nights where I just came in. It's like, I'm just going to play music and dick around. Then I see Nick is on Facebook. It's like, Nick, you mind if I call? No, please, come here, go ahead and call. So I did. Nick came on. Chris called up, and this is a keeper, and I think I want to post this after I posted Adam Gorightly from a couple weeks ago. Thanks for listening. I hope there were still people on. I had a lot of listeners I saw, but I had to shut that off because I was trying to keep the internet Wi-Fi and bandwidth usage down. But we'll be back next week with Rob Sterling from The Conformist. The week after that, Ken Thomas, famous Ken Thomas of Steam Shovel Press, will be here in the studio with me. And after that, possibly, I'm trying to get here Bob Emenegger. One of the listeners suggested the Robert Anton Wilson roundtable, which I will get Gorightly and a couple people here on. And things are just coming together in spite of my efforts to not do anything. So we'll see what happens. So stay tuned for At the Show with Bob. And here, for no reason whatsoever, is Ain't No UFO Gonna Catch My Diesel by Joe Dolts. I think it's pronounced. See you next week.
Howdy. I'm Big Joe Texas, and I'd like to tell you something that happened to me out on the highway. The sun was setting out on the dust of Texas Turnpike. I was just about a mile from the Oklahoma line. When all of a sudden, between you and me, I saw a flying saucer. Swear to God, nearly caused me to collide. Well, pulled up right alongside of my semi. Yeah, saw a little green man with a smile on his little green face. Said something to me, sound like Chinese or something. I couldn't.